going strong, the Nairi told him. We're doing good. It's time I got out on my own. It was 1997. The man was fully integrated into Jalisco, thinking of the town as home now. He owned property there. He had a woman, livestock, and respect. In the plaza, parents whose sons he had hired came up to him and shook his hand. One even gave him a pig, another a cow. He now had the contacts to bring in his own supply up north. The man contacted Daniel, that card dealer in Reno, who produced a telephone number for his uncle, Chucky, in Columbus. Call him, Daniel said. He'll help hook you up with everyone you need. The man returned to Jalisco. He bought a house near the beach in San Blas, Nayarit's main tourist town. He relaxed for 6 months. But no money was coming in, and his woman was spending a lot. So after 6 months of kicking back, he returned to the United States in 1998, thinking it was now time to expand east. He looked at a map and saw three cities in a row, Indianapolis, Dayton, and Columbus. He figured he would try his luck. On June 11, 1998, he flew into Indianapolis and found a cheap motel off Washington Street, the hooker stroll on the east side of town. Watch out, man, said the motel clerk as he checked in. There's a tornado coming. Stay away from the window and look for a place to get low. The man had never seen a tornado. He watched with special concentration that afternoon as the sky got dark and a wind attacked. The wind blew the rain sideways and it hit his window like volleys of BBs. It was not cool, like the rain in California, but eerily warm. Then a massive dark funnel a quarter mile wide, roaring like a jet plane, came right down Washington Street. He watched it rip roofing off a Pizza Hut and shred a daycare center. A man parked his car and scurried his family indoors. A moment later, the car was gone. They found it three blocks away. The tornado was one of eight that tore through central Indiana that evening. No one died. Still, it was an unsettling introduction, and the man never felt right in Indianapolis after that. The next day, he bought a used car, a brown Cadillac Cimarron, a model so poorly conceived and designed that many marked it as a seminal event in the decline of Detroit. But it didn't stand out, and cost only $2,000. Camping out in front of the town's methadone clinic, he gave away samples of his dope, and soon had a client list of desperate junkies, avid for the black tar they'd never seen before. Then one day, cops stopped him after seeing a couple exiting his Cimarron near the clinic. We've got reports you've been dealing heroin. Check the car, he replied. I got no drugs. I was just dropping them off. He nodded in the couple's direction. 'Cause they needed a ride. The cops found nothing. But they told him, we have a photograph of you and your car. Every time we see you, we're stopping you. So he moved on to Dayton, with a kid he brought in from his Reno store. They hooked up with a dealer, a black guy retired from Delphi, the GM Auto Parts Company, who seemed to know every addict in town. Sure enough, no one in Ohio had seen this kind of dope. But he never forgot Daniel's message and the promise of Columbus. One sunny summer day, after they had been in Dayton a couple of weeks, he left the kid with a Delphi retiree and he drove to Columbus. He found a motel off Highway 70 west of town and called Daniel's uncle, Chucky. They met at the town's methadone clinic off Bryden Road the next morning. The clinic was a hive of illegal dope trading. Almost anything a user wanted was for sale. He gave Chucky a few free samples and his beeper number. That afternoon, Chucky called. That's some killer stuff you got, he said. I got a whole bunch of people want some of that. The man drove back to Dayton and pulled up stakes. We were selling a lot, he told me. But the thing I didn't like in Dayton was we were dealing with a lot of blacks. I don't deal with blacks if I don't have to. In the long run, they'll rip you off. They'll hurt your kids. They'll pistol whip you. Columbus had more white people, it appeared, and a large community of Mexicans in which to mingle. He pointed the Cimarron east again to the vast expanses of central Ohio and the state capital, surrounded by large white suburbs and highways. Close to four states, and the put-upon region of Appalachia, where, up to that point, no one had seen much heroin. What's OxyContin? Portsmouth, Ohio. One Friday shortly before Christmas in 1997, a reporter from the Portsmouth Daily Times called Ed Hughes. Hughes ran the counseling center, Portsmouth's lone addiction treatment clinic. The reporter asked if he could come to the staff's party to write a story about staying sober over the holidays. Hughes agreed. The reporter interviewed some of the staff, asking especially about the younger clients. Midway through the party, the reporter took Hughes aside. What's OxyContin? Hughes hadn't heard of it. Some of your clients say they're using it. The next Monday, Hughes began calling around. His staff told him the drug had started showing up recently, that it contained a large amount of oxycodone, and that users had learned to crush it and snort it. He called colleagues at treatment centers in northern Ohio, describing what Portsmouth was seeing. No one in Cleveland, Akron, Columbus, or Cincinnati knew anything about OxyContin. Had Hughes made calls into the rest of Appalachia, he would have heard a far different story, one that resembled what was just getting started in Portsmouth. But at the time, he said, we didn't realize that we were essentially on the cutting edge of a crisis. Around that time, Karen Charles and her husband, Jerry, were making plans to move their flooring shop into a building on Biggs Lane in South Shore, Kentucky, across the Ohio River from Portsmouth. The Charleses knew that a doctor named David Proctor had a practice at the beige metal building next door. In the months after relocating, they saw his business was a lot larger than they'd figured. The traffic, in fact, kept growing. It seemed like no other doctor's practice they knew. Proctor's waiting room could no longer accommodate the crowds. Proctor's clinic often stayed open well past its posted business hours. People parked along Little Biggs Lane all day long waiting to see him. They'd eat two meals in their cars, said Karen. Many patients were from other counties, even other states. Karen Charles remembers Missouri and Arkansas license plates. Unsavory folks, most of them. They blocked access to the Charles Flooring parking lot. A fight once erupted between Proctor clients and a truck driver blocked from making a delivery. On another occasion, someone called in a bomb threat, and police evacuated the clinic, along with the Charles's flooring shop and nearby houses. Karen Charles never dared enter the Proctor clinic, but she heard he was selling OxyContin. It changed everything around here, she said years later. It was something else, something I hoped to never be around again. I talked to him a few times. I don't know how he expected us to run a business. Little old ladies are not going to come in the store with such riffraff hanging around. A reporter from the Portsmouth Daily Times eventually wrote a very different story from the one that ran after that Christmas party. The story talked about a new trend in addiction in southern Ohio and neighboring states. Opiates, primarily oxycodone, delivered most prominently in that new pill called OxyContin. About a week after the second story ran, Ed Hughes received a telephone call from a lawyer representing Purdue Pharma. The caller threatened to sue the counseling center if Hughes ever said in print that OxyContin was addictive. This startled Hughes, who wasn't quoted as saying that OxyContin was addictive. The counseling center was mentioned in the Daily Times story, but it was the young clients who said they were addicted to the drug. He wondered how the company, based in Connecticut, had spotted the story in the tiny newspaper. Something big was going on, he said. How did they know that article showed up in the Portsmouth Daily Times unless they were tracking that kind of information? The counseling center that Hughes ran had begun in a small house 17 years earlier. Hughes, a recovering alcoholic, felt rehabilitation really involved rebuilding an enslaved person. He believed recovery was possible only with a multidisciplinary approach to treating the addict. A continuum of care, Hughes said. An addict in treatment needed a 12-step program, but he also needed help finding housing, with writing a resume, and with finding childcare and clothes for job interviews. These services had to be close by. Addicts usually had no car, no driver's license, and no gas money. Hughes had seen people go back to drugs because they hadn't been able to get to a court date or an appointment with a doctor or a probation officer. By the late 90s, the counseling center had moved into a large new building for outpatients. It also had a small house for men and the only rehab residence in Ohio for female addicts with children. The center had room for all the alcoholics and cocaine users who came to it. About the time of that Christmas party in 1997, Hughes figured he would spend the next year consolidating and improving the center's internal workings, rather than expanding to meet the area's need. That had been accomplished, he thought. Not even close. Portsmouth was about to become ground zero of an almost viral explosion of opiate use and abuse. By the spring of 1998, oxy addicts were everywhere, mostly young and white. It was like a wildfire, Hughes remembered. This drug scourge had a different origin from others he had seen. In Portsmouth, it began with what came to be called pill mills, a business model invented in town, but growing from the aggressive nationwide prescribing of opiates, particularly OxyContin. A pill mill was a pain management clinic, staffed by a doctor with little more than a prescription pad. A pill mill became a virtual ATM for dope, as the doctor issued prescriptions to hundreds of people a day. There were doctors putting a lot of this stuff out in the street, Hughes said. There were long lines. This form of marketing the drug to a drug-addicted people, I don't think that had been done before. Smack Clans and the Sanctuary, Chimayo, New Mexico. Jim Kirkendall grew from classic Drug Enforcement Administration lineage. His uncle, Travis Kirkendall, retired as Assistant Special Agent in charge of the DEA's El Paso office. His father, Jaime Kirkendall, worked for Customs and Border Patrol in the 1960s, running the Texas-Mexico border, fighting the then incipient drug gangs. His father's Christian name was James, but he grew up in the small Texas border town of Eagle Pass and married a Mexican woman. Embracing both cultures, he was known as Jaime. The Kirkendall brothers joined the DEA when it formed from several federal agencies in 1973. Jaime Kirkendall opened the DEA's office in Guayaquil, Ecuador, shortly thereafter. Jim Kirkendall spent much of his youth there, thinking his dad was some kind of James Bond, but not really knowing what it is that his father did. In the 1980s, Jaime Kirkendall moved to Mexico. He was Guadalajara station chief for the DEA in 1985, when traffickers kidnapped, tortured, and murdered his agent, Enrique Quique Camarena, a killing that was covered up by Mexican government officials in league with traffickers. The murder traumatized the new DEA and intensified its focus on Mexico. The episode was the topic of a classic book, later made into a movie called Desperados, by journalist Elaine Shannon. Jaime Kirkendall wrote his own book on the Camarena episode, O Plomo o Plata, Silver or Lead. In college in Texas, Jim Kirkendall first studied journalism, but then, working as a campus police officer, he switched his major to criminal justice. One night he had dinner with a DEA agent, an old drinking buddy of his father's. "Think about applying to the DEA," the agent told him. Other federal law enforcement agencies, the DEA man said, controlled their people from above to an almost stifling degree. Oversight limited the freedom of an agent had in conducting an investigation. In part because of the kind of work the DEA did, individual agents had unmatched control over cases and could make them as big as their own abilities dictated. Unlike local policing, DEA agents had the chance to travel and live abroad, and the department would prize an agent like Kirkendall, fluent in Spanish. That sounded like an adventure. Not long after graduating in 1987, Jim Kirkendall applied to the agency where his father and his uncle were living legends. He did tours in Beaumont, Texas, and Bogota, Colombia, before returning to the United States in 1998. He was stationed in Albuquerque, New Mexico, the senior agent in the office. By that point in his career, Jim Kirkendall had seen that his father's buddy was right. A DEA agent could make a difference, aided by the enormous power of the federal government's conspiracy laws. These statutes allowed the government to charge a person for involvement in a criminal enterprise, even if there was no immediately incriminating evidence, no drugs in an apartment when the cops searched, for example. Wiretap cases were about what was happening at that moment. The conspiracy cases Kuykendall grew to prefer had more to do with what had happened in the past. They did not depend so much on dangerous undercover buys or finding a suspect in possession of lots of dope. Instead, they required agents to go back through the record, cobble together witnesses and reports of past arrests, showing a pattern of, say, a group selling drugs over many years. Defense attorneys criticized conspiracy cases at times as too broad, sweeping up, for example, everyone a defendant contacts. But Kuykendall found that conspiracy cases appealed to his inner journalist. Conspiracy cases required telling a story. Using conspiracy statutes, an agent learned part of the story of a criminal enterprise as he made a case, then flipped the defendants and came back with more arrests and learned the whole story, or at least most of it. Telling the full story of a criminal enterprise had a lot to do with justice, Kuykendall came to believe, for little of what these enterprises really were was apparent on the day of a bust. Jim Kuykendall had made several cases like this in his career, and as he settled into his job in Albuquerque, he would make another up in the small town of Chimayo, New Mexico. Chimayo, with a population of less than 4,000 people, was founded 500 years ago by Spanish conquistadors. It is 25 miles from Santa Fe, in the verdant Española Valley. The town is known for several things. It is the lowrider capital of the world. Residents are obsessed with the dressed-up, low-slung cars. Chimayo's cherry red heirloom chilies are powerful, and their seeds have been passed down through generations of growers. A small adobe church in Chimayo, built in 1816, attracts thousands of pilgrims and tourists a year. The milk chocolate soil around the church is said to cure illnesses. Some 25 tons of it is sold each year to people who rub it on their bodies or simply keep it in small plastic cases. Every night, Chimayo residents venture into the hills, dig up more soil, and deposit it at the shrine. Every Good Friday, 30,000 pilgrims come to the small adobe Santuario de Chimayo, as the church is known, some walking from Albuquerque, 90 miles away. But the town is also known for an illness the soil hasn't cured. Chimayo has the highest rate of heroin addiction in America. When people discuss heroin addiction in Chimayo, they tend to talk of it in terms of a culture, something passed down through generations. Entire Chimayo families are addicted, beginning with the grandparents or even great-grandparents. This had been true for many years when Jim Kuykendall, a few weeks into his job, called Chris Valdez, a New Mexico State Police narcotics officer up in the Española Valley. When Valdez was growing up in the area, this illness was known but hidden. By the time he became a cop, though, heroin was about all Valdez ever saw. Several families, whose ancestors had been in the valley since the 1600s, sold the heroin. In the cloistered world of tiny Chimayo, no one could touch them. Attic burglaries and car break-ins, meanwhile, grew worse every year. For decades, Chimayo addicts had subsisted on powder heroin that Valdez assumed came from Asia somewhere. It had been cut often and was weak. Then, sometime in about 1997, Mexicans arrived and began providing potent and cheap black tar heroin. Chimayo dealers wouldn't let the Mexicans sell in town, but they were happy to buy this new product wholesale and parcel it out to their customers. That's when things seemed to unravel fast. With almost unlimited supply, users who controlled their addiction used far more. People stole wantonly, and those who had lived for years on weak powder heroin began to die on the strong black tar. Not long after moving to Albuquerque, Kuykendall went up to the valley, and Valdez drove him around. The police officer pointed out the mobile homes of heroin dealers, double and triple wides being especially prized among valley residents. Chimayo was an insular place, Valdez said. Cops were hated, but needles were everywhere, and overdose deaths were rising steadily. Few homes kept a stereo or television for long. Three clans dealt heroin. The Barelas, with Felix its patriarch, and his many brothers, several of whom were strung out. There was Josefa Galagos, whose son Brian lived in a shack out back behind her house, her arms rotting from tar heroin injections. Finally, there was Fat Jose and Jesse Donuts Martinez and their relatives. These families had the nicest mobile homes and best lowriders. Felix Barela's lowrider was the finest in the valley, a dark purple Thunderbird known as the Wizard. The dealer families loved Harleys, too, another prized possession in Chimayo. Felix Barela also had several fine racehorses, including Red Hot Mag, the state's best quarter horse. Each clan ran virtual convenience stores of dope, with 50 to 100 addicts coming every day, some three times a day. As the death toll rose through 1998 and into 1999, families of dead addicts, joined by priests from a New Mexico order known as Hermanos Los Penitentes, began protest processions through the mountains to the santuario. They bore signs with the names of people who had died from overdoses or been killed by burglars. Kirkendall left, shocked by the problem. Still, it appeared to be a local, not federal issue. Retail street dealing, it seemed to him. A few weeks later, though, Valdez called. "Get up here tomorrow," he said. "There's a meeting of a Chimayo crime prevention organization. People are mad." That night, Kirkendall walked into the Rancho de Chimayo restaurant and was startled to see congressmen, judges, the head of the New Mexico State Police, and city councilmen, along with Bruce Richardson, the board of the Chimayo Crime Prevention Group. Richardson spoke. "Criminal clans ran the valley, and children were finding used syringes." "You have done nothing," Richardson told the officials that night. He brought forward a large pickle jar filled with used syringes. The public officials gave what Kirkendall considered elected official responses, appeasing no one. He drove home to Albuquerque that night. The politicians' presence told him that they knew things were bad. He had always told younger agents to focus on the biggest dealer wherever they were stationed. "That dealer may not be Pablo Escobar," he would say, "but the biggest dealer in a small town is still a problem to that town." The next day, Kirkendall opened a case against Chimayo's three heroin clans. Liberace Shows the Way, Portsmouth, Ohio. By the end of the 1990s, Dr. David Proctor was one of the few people doing well in Portsmouth, Ohio. He had himself a $750,000 mansion with a swimming pool, African art, and 2 7-foot bronze storks. He owned a Mercedes, a Porsche, and a red Corvette, rare possessions in the Ohio River Valley. In the late 1980s, the Kentucky Board of Medical Licensure investigated patient complaints of unethical practices against him. Board agents found that he prescribed opiates aggressively and often without much diagnosis or follow-up. He was found to have violated no Kentucky medical regulation and retained his license, but was placed on probation. In fact, the state records reflected a doctor who prescribed the drugs often, yet discontinued them just as frequently, who consulted other physicians and urged his chronic pain patients to use exercise or physical therapy to control their pain. David Proctor seemed to be searching for solutions to what ailed his patients. A decade later, that had changed. A nurse in California once told me, "When you deal with people who are in pain all day long, after a while, you get worn down." Something like that happened to David Proctor. More patient complaints in the 1990s prompted a second state investigation. By then, those records show, he regularly prescribed Valium, Vicodin, the sedative Soma, Xanax, and a steady regimen of Redux diet pills, all with almost no diagnosis or suggestions for other treatment, such as physical therapy. Nor was there any discussion of improving diet as a way to lose weight and reduce pain. As I read the licensure board investigative reports, it seemed that many years in deindustrialized America, seeing vulnerable people and manipulative people who use drugs and the government dole to navigate economic disaster, had corroded any medical ethics Proctor once possessed. So I went to Portsmouth to see if I could learn more about the doctor whom locals called the godfather of the pill mill, the man who had started the first business and showed others how it was done. No one in Portsmouth had forgotten David Proctor, though he was long gone by then. Some remembered him fondly. Many said they had gone to his clinic and waited in long lines for dope prescriptions. One of them was Kathy Newman, who in 1996 was a high school cheerleader and the daughter of a contractor. Kathy had just graduated from Portsmouth High School when she broke ribs in a car accident. The emergency room in town was wary of prescribing more than ibuprofen for pain. "You should go see David Proctor," her friend said. "He'll give you something that works." Kathy drove to the South Shore Clinic and walked into a madhouse. The room was packed. People were standing in the aisles, tense and greedy with anticipation. After 3 hours, she got in to see the doctor. Proctor prescribed her Vicodin and spent a half hour telling her she would probably have back and hip pain for the rest of her life, and thus would need this prescription for that long as well. Newman went along with it, not sure what to think. "I'm scared to death. I'm so young and afraid that I was going to be on this the rest of my life," she said. In fact, those Vicodins led to a 14-year addiction that eventually had Newman shooting up OxyContin and getting pill prescriptions from a half dozen doctors around town. Years disappeared in zoned-out addiction. She once found herself in an abandoned farmhouse with people she didn't know, unaware how she got there. A pit bull ran through the living room, chased by an enraged rooster. The pain treatment revolution had many faces, and these mostly belonged to well-meaning doctors and dedicated nurses. But in the Rust Belt, another kind of pain had emerged. Waves of people sought disability as a way to survive as jobs departed. Legions of doctors arose who were not so well-meaning, or who simply found a livelihood helping people who were looking for a monthly government disability check as a solution to unemployment. By the time the pain revolution changed U.S. medicine, the Ohio River Valley had a class of these docs. They were an economic coping strategy for a lot of folks. They charged cash for each visit and were quick with a prescription pad, willing to go along with whatever the patient claimed was pain, wherever the patient claimed he had it. Then along came OxyContin. If heroin was the perfect drug for drug traffickers, OxyContin was ideal for these pill mill doctors. The drug had several things going for it, as far as they were concerned. First, it was a pharmaceutically produced pill with a legal medical use. Second, it created addicts, and not just among those who looked to abuse it, but among many who came in search of pain relief. Every patient who was prescribed the drug stood a chance of soon needing it every day. These people were willing to pay cash. They never missed an appointment. If diagnosis wasn't your concern, a clinic was a low overhead operation, a rented building, a few waiting rooms, some office staff, and bouncers. These clinics did require bouncers. They also required a physician with a DEA registration number that permitted him to prescribe federally designated Schedule II narcotics like OxyContin. Prescriptions for Schedule II drugs had to be written each month by a doctor for a patient, who had to come to the office in person. That meant a monthly visit fee from every patient, $250 usually, and that kept waiting rooms full and cash rolling in. Among the very first docs in America to figure out the potency of OxyContin as a business model was David Proctor in Portsmouth, Ohio. He believed all his patients. Not only that, he encouraged them to believe in imaginary pain. "Injured people start going to him and he gives them this new wonderful medicine, OxyContin," said Lisa Roberts, a public health nurse in Portsmouth, who had worked with Proctor years before at a hospital where he had privileges. "Soon, they're getting addicted. They'd say my pain's getting worse," and he'd increase the dose. "I started seeing people I know, who are hard-working, decent people, acting all bizarre, rolling cars, stealing." Danny Colley, who grew up in Portsmouth's rough East End neighborhood, watched Proctor's gradual corruption. Proctor had been his family's doctor when he was a child. At 20, now fully involved in the drug world, Collie visited his former doctor's clinic. Proctor was the first cash-only doc around, and was by then prescribing Xanax and Lortabs for everything. Later, he became the first to prescribe OxyContin for Collie. His clinic was full. He was the one guy and he was burning it down, Collie said. When he gave me my Lortabs, he said, put these under your tongue and let them melt. Do not snort them. When I got my first oxys, he told me to be careful but that I could snort those. His exact words. He gave me the same thing he said he was taking. He's giving me the dope I need so I'm not sick. I thought he was my dude. I thought he was looking out for me. I thought it was the coolest thing ever. Collie went to Proctor after being injured on a job. He got workers' comp to pay for my medicine for a year and a half, Collie said. He was helping with that. He had a photographic fucking memory. We all thought he was the smartest person in the world. He was brilliant, but he was a crook. Local doctors took a cue from Proctor. Dr. John Lilly opened in downtown Portsmouth. He had lines out the door, too. After that, things opened wide. Kathy Newman noticed it wasn't just the unscrupulous docs. It seemed every physician in town was under the influence of opiate's remarkable pain-killing potential. Anyway, she could find no doctor in Portsmouth offering a pain solution that didn't involve opiates. They'd be like, well, let's try you on Lorset 10s. Oh, that didn't work for a month? Let's move you on to 20s, Kathy Newman said. Within 3 months of me telling them that Vicodin 5s aren't working anymore, I was on Oxy 20s, paying cash all the way. Doctors prescribed those drugs. The other truth, though, is that opiates were all most patients demanded in southern Ohio by then. 50 miles away, an addict who sometimes went by the name of Jeremy Wilder saw Easy Money and grabbed it. Wilder, a tall, lanky guy with a heavy Appalachian drawl, was raised downriver from Portsmouth in the one stoplight town of Aberdeen, situated between two power plants in Brown County. Jeremy was a union carpenter, but he grew up around the kind of moral ambivalence that characterized life in the small Ohio River Valley towns as the Rust Belt took shape. The easy money got the better of him. In 1995, Jeremy heard that Dr. Fortune Williams had been hired by David Proctor to start up a clinic out in Garrison, Kentucky. Williams was the first doc Jeremy went to, as he emerged as one of the first pill dealers in his county. He paid Williams $250 for the visit and $200 more for prescriptions that included OxyContin. Jeremy later found a doctor in Williamsburg, Ohio, and another in Portsmouth to supply him with pills as well. I met Jeremy as I traveled the heartland of the opiate plague, bisected by the Ohio River. Through him, I realized that as the pain revolution spread, powered by OxyContin, the area once starved for health care had seen doctors descend on it like locusts. By the mid-1990s, Jeremy Wilder was the biggest pill dealer in Aberdeen, while still working carpentry jobs in Cincinnati and around southern Ohio. He had a window in his house to which users in the area literally beat a path. At first, Jeremy didn't use the drugs he sold. But one night at a party, he broke down and snorted an oxy. That was it. Soon he was selling to support his habit. Then, in Cincinnati one day, he couldn't find oxys. A neighbor of his Cincinnati connection could get something else. Black tar heroin. Jeremy balked. He wanted no part of heroin. But the next day, he couldn't take the dope sick anymore. The guy phoned a Mexican who brought over small balloons of black tar heroin. Jeremy never took the pills again. For the next 2 years, he barely existed. He drove daily to Cincinnati to buy pills from a woman and his tar from the Mexicans. He sold the pills to pay for the heroin he used. For a while, each balloon he bought from the Mexicans came with a paper attached and a phone number. Call anytime. He never forgot that. He guessed they were just starting out. He was new to heroin and wondered if all traffickers marketed like that, but figured they did not. In late 1998, Jeremy Wilder, from the town of Aberdeen in rural Brown County, was among the first in southern Ohio to make the transition from OxyContin to heroin. He was not the last. About that year, reports from the Kentucky Board of Medical Licensure's second investigation into David Proctor began telling strange tales. He was losing all control, manipulating damaged and addicted women for sex. one upset Kentucky medical inspector, who reviewed dozens of Proctor patient records during the late 1990s, used terms like gross incompetence, negligence, and malpractice. Proctor, the inspector wrote, didn't even record a patient's height, weight, pulse, or temperature. Dr. Proctor's records are extremely poor, and I am unable to tell what exactly was prescribed in each visit from his notes, he wrote. Of a second Proctor patient, there is significant lack of evidence of evaluation and alternative treatment to this patient, except for the use of controlled substances. And a third, there did not appear to be any type of practice of medicine involved, except the description of symptoms by the patient and the doctor writing for controlled substances. I do not believe this constitutes the practice of medicine. Patient complaints prompted the investigation. Among them, three women reported they repeatedly had sex with Proctor in his office at his insistence in exchange for prescriptions. One said Proctor pushed her to have sex with him, threatening not to give her an office job or help with her husband's workers' compensation claim if she did not allow him to lick her vagina, though her toddler son was in the room when he did it. Another went to Proctor for depression that grew from an abortion she had had at 18. On the first visit, she said, Proctor told her to write a letter outlining all her problems, which they would review. With each visit, she would write a letter about her emotional problems, which he would review, and then have sex with her. After a few such visits, the letter reading was dispensed with, and Proctor got straight to the sex. On the last of 20 visits, she took a drug overdose in his office, and he had a nurse drive her home. After that, she told investigators, she entered drug rehab. In November 1998, Proctor had a car accident. He claimed it left him with short-term memory loss, unable to practice medicine. People were skeptical. Some suggested Proctor use the injuries as a ruse, saying he could no longer remember where certain patients' records were or how he had treated them. Either way, he relinquished his medical license to the state of Kentucky, but kept his pain clinic open. He hired doctors from across the county to staff it, docs for whom the job of wantonly prescribing opiates was the only one available. In the hollowing out of small-town America, the pill mill doc was a kind of coup de grace. In so many towns, locally owned businesses had expired. Family diners were replaced by Applebee's and town hardware stores by Home Depot. Then ersatz pain physicians replaced family docs and became about the only health care some towns had. Around northern Kentucky and southern Ohio, Proctor's docs were initially hailed for coming to the area. In truth, they were vinegar in the mouth of a crucified region. In the 3 years following his car accident, Proctor hired 15 doctors. They arrived with histories of drug use, previously suspended licenses, and mental problems, ready to prescribe while working for Proctor for $2,500 a week. Some of these doctors stayed. They learned the business. Then they left to set up their own pain clinics in nearby small towns, taking with them office staff trained by Proctor. One Kentucky lawman dubbed him Ray Kroc, for the man who spread McDonald's restaurants worldwide. Proctor's business model spread like a virus, unleashing unstable doctors on a vulnerable region. Dr. Frederick Cohn worked for Proctor before relocating to an abandoned supermarket in the town of Paintsville, population 3,400, in eastern Kentucky, where he saw as many as 146 patients a day, 3 minutes each, while lines formed outside. Cohn had pre-printed prescriptions for various narcotics, including OxyContin, Lortab, Soma, and Xanax. He prescribed the same pills in the same amounts over and over throughout the day, no matter the patient's complaint. 2.7 million pills in 1 year. Dr. Stephen Snyder worked for Proctor for several months in 1999 before leaving to start his own pain clinic. Snyder once had his medical license suspended in Indiana and Florida for drug use. He was a long-time drug user. But in 1997, apparently unaware of his past, the state of Kentucky granted him an osteopath's license. While working for Proctor, Snyder was addicted to Lorset and was injecting OxyContin while writing narcotics prescriptions 10 and 12 hours a day. he told a DEA investigator that he often split prescriptions with patients, supplying his habit and that of his wife. Dr. Fortune Williams worked for Proctor before moving to Garrison, Kentucky, where he worked in a clinic owned by Nancy Sadler, a former Proctor employee. On some days, he saw patients for 90 seconds at a time and issued 46,000 controlled substance prescriptions for a total of 2.3 million pills in 9 months. Dr. Rodolfo Santos worked in Proctor's clinic for a while, during which time at least one of his patients died. An investigator wrote that Santos displayed gross ignorance, gross negligence, gross incompetence, and a level of care that I would not find acceptable in a first-year medical student. Santos said he knew he was dealing with addicted patients who lied, who scammed drugs from him, but that he was trying to educate them. Who will help them? He told an investigator. As the pain revolution spread across the country, so too did pain clinics. Places where people in pain went for treatment, most often in the form of the opiate painkillers that were now accepted in modern medicine. The pain clinic became a business model, repeated over and over, and many were legitimate. But the business also attracted doctors who were unethical or compromised from the start. Even doctors whose intentions were honorable occasionally had their scruples worn out and warped by the temptation and constant pressure from pain patients and drug-seeking addicts. In either case, many clinics became places where doctors dispensed prescriptions like candy for cash and became known as pill mills. Once these businesses got going, they didn't just prescribe opiate painkillers, such as Vicodin or OxyContin. There also emerged, in the wake of David Proctor, a taste in the Rust Belt in Appalachia for the class of psychoactive drugs known as benzodiazepines. Valium was the first benzo, but Xanax bars were the most popular. As Proctor showed his clients, benzodiazepines combined with opiates were especially potent and addictive. Both were depressants and very dangerous when taken together. But addicts grew to love the two together as benzos seemed to enhance the euphoria of the opiates. The combined prescription of opiates and benzos was a hot ticket at pill mills in Portsmouth and elsewhere. I asked a detective, seasoned by investigations into many of these clinics, to describe the difference between a pill mill and a legitimate pain clinic. "Look at the parking lot," he said. "If you see lines of people standing around outside, smoking, people getting pizza delivered, fistfights, and traffic jams, if you see people in pajamas who don't care what they look like in public, that's a pill mill." And that's what popped up all over Portsmouth, growing from David Proctor's first clinic. Proctor, meanwhile, gained the DEA's attention. The agency launched an investigation into Plaza Healthcare. Proctor pleaded guilty to conspiring to distribute prescription medication. Then he fled to Canada with a Cincinnati bail bondswoman who was neither his wife nor his mistress a few days before he was to be sentenced. They were captured at the Canadian border with $40,000 and plane tickets to the Cayman Islands. His lawyer, Gary Rocky Billiter, aided the escape. Proctor was returning to Kentucky, where he had already testified against Drs. Williams and Santos in court in return for a lighter sentence in his own case. He eventually served 11 years in prison. Santos and Williams also went off to prison, as did Cohn and Snyder and Billiter. With that, the era of the pill mill owned by doctors from out of town drew to a close in Portsmouth, Ohio. David Proctor ended up at the federal prison and hospital in Lexington, Kentucky, that once was the narcotic farm. I wrote to him there, toward the end of his sentence, asking to hear what he had to say about Portsmouth, pills, pain clinics, and his legacy. He declined, and a year later was released. As the pain revolution was taking hold across the country, however, Proctor and his physician progeny showed a beat-down region a brand new business model. Before long, some of the first locally owned businesses in years opened in Portsmouth, known to folks in town as the Pain Managements. The Man in the Heartland, Columbus, Ohio. The city of Columbus, Ohio, in many ways is a fine replica of the United States. Its income and age distribution, its racial demographics and diversity of opinion, make Columbus a microcosm of America, and one that marketers especially prize. There's a large white population and moderate numbers of blacks. Unlike other parts of Ohio, Columbus has sizable immigrant groups from Mexico, Somalia, Nepal, and other parts of Asia, who flock to town to fill the low-end service jobs. A large college student population at Ohio State and other schools has kept it vibrant and edgy. No place, apparently, represents the country more faithfully, and for that reason, Columbus, Ohio has been known as the test market capital of the United States for several years now. These days, it's no longer Peoria, but Columbus that marketers use as a barometer of America. White Castle and Wendy's and more than a dozen other fast food chains headquarter there. Many companies have used the town to gauge interest in new product offerings, placing them in stores in Columbus first before rolling out those products nationally. McDonald's tested its McRib in Columbus, and Wendy's and Panera have tested prototype stores there as well. Taco Bell's BLT tacos were tested in the Columbus market. R.J. Reynolds tried tobacco in the form of a mint that did away with secondhand smoke. Giant Eagle's massive Market District supermarket in Columbus tests a variety of concepts, among them the sale of wine by the glass. If you raked America together, in the center you'd find Columbus. And I think that's really what makes us a unique testbed, as opposed to being average, a spokesman for the Columbus Partnership told CBS News in a story in which the reporter concluded, "What they choose in Columbus today may very well determine what you will buy tomorrow." By the end of 1998, the man was proving that true of black tar heroin as well. For the bounties of Columbus, he discovered, were indeed ample. A metro area of close to 2 million, Columbus wasn't Youngstown or Cleveland. It had no organized mafias or armed gangs controlling the drug underworld. It was connected by freeways to regional markets as far east as Wheeling, West Virginia, and south to Lexington and eastern Kentucky. There was Cincinnati to the southwest. Plus, all around it were suburbs and farm towns with money. Columbus always was a highly educated community, with a service, not industrial, economy. As parts of the state went into something like permanent recession, in Columbus, the suburbs spread and the malls stayed busy. All this the man saw upon arriving in the summer of 1998, which seems to be the first time Mexican black tar heroin made a large and sustained appearance east of the Mississippi River. Up to then, the Colombian powder was all Columbus dealers could get, usually by driving to New York City, then diluting it before sale. "They were stepping on it 5 or 6 times, the man said. Addicts would buy a $100 bag twice a day just to get well. They'd buy a $40 bag of mine and stay well all day. Mexico's proximity and his connection to the Nayarit poppy supply and Jalisco cookers meant he got the heroin quickly, cheaply, and unadulterated. Enormously potent dope could be sold at scarily low prices. This gave black tar a competitive advantage over heroin from Colombia, Mexico's main heroin competition, and of course, what little arrived from Asia. He immediately sent for 2 more kids from Jalisco, so now he had 3. He brought out a woman from California who rented 2 apartments in her name, one for the workers and one for him. He found a car lot with an amenable owner. Every 2 months, he switched cars. He exchanged an old Honda Accord for a Prelude, and that for a Civic, and then for a Camry, white, beige, gray. He ran 2 shifts of drivers, 8 a.m. to 3 p.m., and 3 p.m. to 9 p.m. They devised codes for places to meet the addicts. 1 was a Burger King, 2 a Kmart parking lot. He tutored his new Jalisco boys. "Never leave the house with anything in your pockets. Take only what you can swallow if you get pulled over, and never carry a gun. An illegal who was arrested gets deported. An illegal with a gun gets 10 years. Some of them still dressed as they had back home, with cowboy boots and belt buckles. "Go to the stores downtown," he told 2 of them one day. "Look how they dress the mannequins at JCPenney's. Buy clothes like that so you blend in with the people here." He insisted they send money home weekly. Most didn't need to be told and religiously sent money to Mom via Western Union. Those who didn't, he knew he would be hearing from their parents. For some kids, he sent the money to their parents' house himself. "Sell to whites, that's where the money is," he told them. "Steer clear of blacks." He didn't have to insist too strongly on this point either. His runners came with their own ideas forged by the negative view of black people common in Mexican culture that was, in turn, reinforced by the stories of returning immigrants who lived in Compton, Watts, and South Central Los Angeles, where powerful black gangs terrorized vulnerable Mexicans. So the Jalisco boys stayed away from black neighborhoods, and this was one reason why, as their system expanded, Nayarit black tar was primarily sold to and used by whites. Otherwise, he had a live-and-let-live attitude. The U.S. market was large enough and tar heroin was addictive enough. It never occurred to him to sell wholesale. Retail, he made almost triple what he would have made selling heroin wholesale. He had a bunch of poor ranchero kids down in Nayarit eager to drive around with tiny balloons in their mouths, so his risk was minimal. And they were only deported when arrested because they usually possessed such small amounts of dope. Selling small quantities allowed him to get the most money out of the dope he got up from Mexico. Plus, as he hired more of these men, his standing in Jalisco improved, and he got respect every time he returned. Columbus had been at the bottom of Ohio's heroin distribution chain. At the time the man arrived, heroin in Columbus was at most 3% pure, old Addicts told me, and even that was hard to get. For years before his arrival, in the entire city of Columbus, Ohio, heroin was sold at precisely one street corner, Mount Vernon Avenue at North 20th Street. The city, instead, had always been a pill town. Pills were easier to trust than low-grade heroin. The advent of black tar heroin in this community suddenly put a much purer-grade heroin on the streets of central Ohio, said Ronnie Pogue, co-founder of Columbus's lone methadone clinic, CompDrug. The hunger for heroin, which had always been there, immediately saw an upward spike, because you also saw a spike in the overdose rate. Columbus had the only methadone clinic for hundreds of miles around. Long before the man arrived, the region's opiate addicts had been traveling into Columbus to score whatever they could find in front of the clinic. As word spread of the high quality of black tar, these pilgrims became some of his first clients. Users from Zanesville, Toledo, Chillicothe, from northern Kentucky and western Virginia. Some of his best clients were from Ashland, Kentucky, who had bought for years in front of Columbus's methadone clinic. They bought his tar and went back to Ashland and sold it for triple. Black tar became the talk of Columbus's drug underworld. It was the most powerful heroin anyone had tried. Plus, the Mexicans soon had a delivery driver in each area. With that, heroin found its way to suburban kids. They broke this city down into dominoes, 30 minutes or less, one veteran addict told me. When you're dope sick, that makes a big difference. Then, every time you found them somebody new, it was a free balloon. Usually it was 7 balloons for $100, but if you brought them enough people and were spending with them, you could get as many as 13 balloons for $100. With addicts transformed into a new sales force, the man was soon making so much money that he had to concentrate less on running the cell and more on getting cash back to Mexico. He formed a network of young women. A tailor in Los Angeles made them corsets with pockets that held $100,000 in cash. He sent the women on airplanes to El Paso, where they crossed his money to Ciudad Juarez, and from there back to Jalisco. For more than a year, he sent 2 girls a month back to Mexico, with $100,000 in pure Columbus, Ohio profit tucked in their corsets. His product was coming in from a man named Oscar Hernandez Garcia, a member of the Tejeda clan who operated a heroin supply business out of his apartment in Panorama City in Los Angeles. Hernandez Garcia, known as Mosca, Fly, had developed a business as a wholesaler, supplying black tar to Jalisco cells from Portland to Phoenix to Columbus and Hawaii. The man used Federal Express to bring the product from Musco's apartment in California. He would go to California and buy a small electric oven from Target or Kmart, open the back of the oven, stuff it with tar heroin, then take it to FedEx for packaging. Police didn't often search a package that FedEx prepared. He sent the ovens to a pliant Columbus addict who lived in the basement of his senile parents' home and paid him in heroin. With Columbus humming along, he looked for new markets. One addict, a kid named Mikey, told him people in Wheeling, West Virginia would go crazy for black tar. Mikey introduced him around Wheeling. There, the man made a startling discovery. Mikey introduced him to a woman in her late 30s, a heroin addict. She showed him a bottle of pills, wanting to trade them for his tar. Oxycontin, the pills were called, she said. He'd never heard the name and turned her down. But it struck him that she drove a new Dodge Durango and owned a house. He'd never known a long-time heroin addict who had a house and new SUV. So he listened to her. Oxycontin, she told him, contained a pharmaceutical opiate, a prescription painkiller similar to heroin. He got to know the woman better. Turned out she traveled the area buying these pills cheap from seniors, then sold them to oxy addicts in the hills of Appalachia. She bought her daily heroin with the money. He couldn't have known it then, but arriving in 1998, he had happened onto the biggest metro area in a 5-state region where, 2 years into the Purdue Pharma promotional campaign, opiate addiction was exploding due to abuse of this new drug called OxyContin. By his own good fortune, not far away was Portsmouth, Ohio, where scandalous pain clinics were just starting to follow the lead of Dr. David Proctor into a new business model of writing prescriptions for millions of these pills to long lines of addicts. Meanwhile, the pain revolution was in full swing in U.S. medicine. Specialists were urging well-meaning doctors everywhere to prescribe opiate painkillers for pain, convinced that when used this way, they were all but non-addictive. Central Ohio, in other words, was about to be a great place to be a heroin dealer. His black tar, once it came to an area where OxyContin had already tenderized the terrain, sold not to tapped-out old junkies, but to younger kids, many from the suburbs, most of whom had money and all of whom were white. Their transition from oxy to heroin, he saw, was a natural and easy one. Oxy addicts began by sucking on and dissolving the pill's timed-release coating. They were left with 40 or 80 milligrams of pure oxycodone. At first, addicts crushed the pills and snorted the powder. As their tolerance built, they used more. To get a bigger bang from the pill, they liquefied it and injected it. But their tolerance never stopped climbing. OxyContin sold on the street for $1 a milligram, and addicts very quickly were using well over 100 milligrams a day. As they reached their financial limits, many switched to heroin, since they were already shooting up oxy and had lost any fear of the needle. Black tar was potent, far cheaper, and his delivery system made it easier to get than the pills. Plus, tar could be smoked, didn't have to be injected, which attracted kids to whom needles were at first anathema. The way he saw it, every oxy addict was a tar junkie in waiting, and there were thousands of new oxy addicts. All he had to do was work it. His Nayarit brothers might never have figured this out. Like many Mexican immigrants who lived in Spanish-only enclaves, they were oblivious to subtle trends in the American society and culture in which they lived. As traffickers, they cared only to sell their dope and send money home. Drivers were short-timers all, on salary, there for 6 to 9 months, holed up in apartments, and knowing only a few words of English, no credit or 15 minutes, exchanged with desperate addicts who spoke no Spanish. Discovering emerging markets required an English speaker who understood the street. Landing in Columbus, just as the region around it was becoming ground zero in America's opiate epidemic, he could see opportunities developing simply because, he told me once, I could talk to the white people. His arrival was a fateful coincidence. Other traffickers might have filled the eventual demand for heroin created in this region where prescription pill abuse got bad first. Later, many did. But few were so ready to take advantage of it, so aggressive in their marketing, and so quickly replenished as the Jalisco boys and the man who brought them there. Wheeling taught the man that new markets were now everywhere the pills were. With the boys working his store in Columbus, he found a place in Carnegie, Pennsylvania, a suburb of Pittsburgh, and close enough to service other towns like Steubenville and Wheeling. He also eyed Nashville. Its Mexican population was growing, nearing 80,000 people. The town, he heard, was swamped in OxyContin. He set up one of his Columbus drivers, along with a new kid up from Jalisco, in a store that was soon booming. Choose the right town, and you can't miss, he thought to himself. The Nashville store covered his expenses for the expansion he eyed throughout the Mid-South. At the urging of another addict, he took a trip down to Virginia, through Roanoke, Richmond, and Newport News. It was another large market, but the federal government had too many installations there. Langley and a naval base made him nervous. He went through Chattanooga, Tennessee, a town with a lively underworld, but too small. Mexicans and cars would stand out. He drove down to Pensacola and Jacksonville, but left. Florida is dominated by Colombians and Cubans and Puerto Ricans. That kind of race? They ain't got no understanding, he said. Kill, kill, kill. They think they can solve everything by killing. I wasn't going to kill nobody over drugs. I'd probably be buried the rest of my life in prison. He nixed Philadelphia, too. It had a huge heroin market, but it was run by the mafia and street gangs. He didn't even consider New York or Baltimore. It was crazy to think that a bunch of Mexican farm boys could break in there. Why would they want to? The country was full of towns like Columbus, wealthy places with growing numbers of addicts, and no competition. So the contours of the Jalisco heroin nation took shape, based largely on the territory the man carved out, by avoiding the biggest cities where heroin markets were already controlled, and by following the OxyContin. He tried to keep his eastern tienditas a secret to his Nayarit friends. When he went back to Reno or Los Angeles to arrange deliveries, he always told people that he was working in New York City. But in a small town like Jalisco, people talked. After a year in Columbus, his drivers went home for the Feria del Elote and started bragging about the great heroin market they were working up in central Ohio. By the fall of 1999, two more crews were in Columbus. One belonged to a former driver, now venturing out on his own. Two more followed. A kind of go-east young man ethos took hold among the Jalisco boys. The price of heroin in Columbus fell. No crew leader could cut his dope unless he wanted to lose his clients. So the product stayed strong, even as it got cheaper. Competition, as always, attuned the Jalisco crews to customer service. They even crossed the city to keep a customer, and gave away free dope to any client hinting at quitting. One woman I met lived 25 miles outside Columbus, and at one point hadn't called to buy for 3 days. A Jalisco boy called her. "Señorita, why haven't you been buying recently?" "I don't have any money," she said. He drove out to deliver $50 worth of heroin to her, for which he required no payment. "No, it's free," he said. "He wanted me to keep using and buying from him," she said. She did both. A year or so after the man settled in Columbus, he drove to Charlotte looking for bigger profits. Addicts told him he would make a million there. No one there had seen anything like black tar heroin. Heroin, in fact, had only a small market in Charlotte. He met junkie contacts at the town's methadone clinic and gave them free samples. Soon, business boomed again. He pulled the driver out of Columbus and another out of Nashville, and they set up the Black Tar heroin franchise in Charlotte. A couple weeks later, the Sanchez family, from the ranchos near Jalisco, arrived. They had an addict guide of their own, a big Native American fellow. The Sanchezes owed their expanding heroin empire to addicts. Addicts had guided the family out of San Fernando to Las Vegas, then to Memphis and Nashville, and from there to Charlotte. The man didn't know them, only knew of them. They were cousins of the late David Tejeda from the rancho of Aquiles Cerdan, down the road from Jalisco. Now they were in Charlotte, too. It was bound to happen. It was a free market, after all. Bodies are the key to the case. Santa Fe, New Mexico. In Chimayo, The Heroin Clan's dominance went back years. It didn't matter that members of these clans had all been arrested, as had their workers. The problem was, Chris Valdez told Jim Kirkendall, that none had done much prison time, then always returned home. The families grew stronger with each demonstration of impunity. Still, the old cases interested Kirkendall. Drugs had been seized in each case. A historical record of the clan's control existed throughout those cases. Kirkendall saw there was a story to be told. Witnesses, people in prison now, users or low-rung workers who could talk about the clans, had been there when the cops barged in on one family or another. Plus, those who died from heroin overdoses could speak from the grave, if only their loved ones would talk. Their stories might tell best of all how deeply the clan's power resided in Chimayo. To Jim Kirkendall, all this history was important, for it formed a story of the clan's control that might become the basis of a federal conspiracy case. He formed a team of local cops and targeted the main heroin-dealing families in Chimayo, and in particular, Felix Varela, who said he made his money from cutting firewood. A short while later, Kirkendall briefed top federal agents and prosecutors. The FBI wanted to contribute agents to go up on wiretaps. Kirkendall resisted. Wiretaps were unnecessary. The key to the case are the bodies, Kirkendall said. They each tell a story. There's a story behind who these people are, where they bought their drugs, and how they died. We need to tell that story. He got the medical examiner's reports of dozens of overdose cases and divided them among the investigators. They fanned across the Española Valley, interviewing families of the deceased. Years before, as black tar heroin accelerated the valley's decay, each dead junkie had been viewed as one less problem. No one had cared enough to interview their families, but the families were integral to the Chimayo heroin tale, Kirkendall believed. Addicts, even those well into adulthood, often returned to live with their parents once they lost their jobs, houses, and spouses. Parents lived in torment, as their children stole from them, slaves to the morphine molecule. It turned out many parents and siblings, unable to withstand the torment that would ensue if they refused, and afraid that if they let their family member borrow the car, they would never be seen again, had driven the addicts to their dealers' houses. These parents, it turned out, were eager to talk. They greeted the investigators with tears and hugs. They recounted watching helplessly as their kids fell apart. One mother, in tears, pinched Kirkendall's cheeks as she made him promise he would get the people who sold her child heroin. These parents said the Barella family, as the school year approached, would hand out lists of what clothes their children needed. When they wanted new televisions or stereos, they'd let the addicts know. Soon junkies would be plying them with newly stolen pants for their kids. One afternoon, Kirkendall went to visit Dennis Smith, the man in his 70s whose son, Donald, had died. Donald Smith had moved back to live with his father after a fight with his girlfriend over his heroin use. Sitting with Kirkendall, the elder Smith said that on the trip home from an outing one night, his son had demanded they return to Chimayo so he could buy heroin. He threatened to jump from the car if his father didn't turn around. Dennis Smith said he drove his son back to the Barella compound, a place where he had taken him several times before. The elder Smith turned the car around and headed back to the Barellas for his kid's dope. He found his son's corpse in the trailer in the back of his property the next morning. One resident, George Roybal, told the detectives that he often took his disabled brother, Ernie, to buy dope from the Barellas and the Martinez's. Another, Lynette Salazar, told them she took her son, Armando, to a clan house, as she had done often, to trade auto supplies for a hit of dope. And from this, Armando died later that day. Kirkendall flew to Montana to visit a woman who had driven through the valley one fall. Enchanted with its natural beauty, she decided to stay. She moved in right next to a member of the Martinez clan. At first, she told Kirkendall, she believed her next-door neighbor, Jesse Donuts Martinez, was a Boy Scout leader from all the youths who would visit the house all afternoon. Soon, though, she saw kids with belts around their arms. Her young son began finding syringes in the yard. She called the cops and began noting every car that pulled up, 30 a day sometimes. She spent a year watching junkies come in and out, shooting up in the backyard in full view of her window, She called police repeatedly. Finally, she gave up and moved to Montana. In the end, the case against the Klans involved relatively few undercover drug buys. It revolved instead around testimony of people whom Kuykendall and the agents had tracked down. The families and friends of the dead